concentration for the social ensembles of Dyson.
Thank you. Okay. May I begin by thanking the organisers for August. I was at the Fields Institute in Toronto and gave a talk about generalised orthogonal ensemble, and Professor Brenier asked me a question as to whether the methods of that talk could extend to other ensembles known in statistical mechanics, and this talk is partly to address this question. So what I'm going to do is describe the circular ensembles of Dyson and describe how one can obtain almost sure convergence and concentration results for these. And then to discuss in fairly great generality how the method can be used to describe other random eigenvalue distributions. And finally, to come back to the generalized orthogonal ensemble, which is in some respects the most technically difficult of these cases, and to emphasize a particular aspect of transportation inequalities. Okay, well, back in 1962, Dyson considered a simple model problem. The idea is that one takes a circular conducting wire, and on this wire one places N electrical charges, and the positions of these are going to be specified by various angles. So we have a unit positive charge at theta j, and we're going to take these to be in increasing order around the circle. And by simple electrostatics, these particles are going to repel one another. So the potential of electrostatic repulsion can be specified in terms of all of the angles. And one has a sum, a minus sign because the charges are like and hence repulsive. The problem is two-dimensional, so it's a logarithmic potential, and I want to take the distance between the points on this wire and to sum over the different choices of j and k, j smaller than k. So this is going to be the electrical energy contained within the system. Now, a few simple observations which are nevertheless important. The problem is rotationally invariant. If we turn the wire around, we're not going to change anything about the electrostatics. Other observation, it's intuitively reasonable that the most likely configuration, one which will have the least energy, will be the one in which the particles are placed at the vertices of a regular n-gon. Now, this is what one would expect, and this is what one can prove. And this is going to dictate what follows in the future. Now, as is usual in these sort of problems in statistical mechanics, we're going to introduce a phase space, which is the set of all these angles. And the ensemble is going to be specified in terms of a certain probability measure. And we'll just write down the general formula. It's going to be something like sigma n. There's going to be some constant depending on beta to make it a probability. So beta is the inverse temperature. We get W of theta, and then we integrate this over the various angles. Okay, so that's the general setup. Now, the ensembles have the following form. Once one takes the exponential of the logarithm, it becomes a product over the various angle differences, and the inverse temperature becomes a positive power. In the case in which beta equals 1, 1 refers to the orthogonal ensemble, beta equals 2, the unitary ensemble, and beta equals 4, the symplectic ensemble. Now, what I'm going to do is discuss in detail the beta equals 2 case, and then go on to describe how this same method can be used to deal with the cases of beta equals 1 and beta equals 4.
Special value for the inverse temperature?
One can prove similar results for all positive beta. Now, the positions of the eigenvalues can be described in terms of a certain probability measure, which is obtained by taking a unit mass at each of these points, weighting it by a factor of 1 over n, and then taking the sum over the different choice of j from j equals 1 to n. So this means that this quantity mu n is the empirical distribution of the eigenvalues, so it is to be treated as being random, subject to the ensemble sigma. Okay, so this is in a sense a random measure because one thinks of the positions here as being random, subject to the measure. Now, in 1988, Johansson proved that for these ensembles, if one lets n increase so that there are more and more particles, they pack together in such a way that their distribution becomes uniform in the sense of being like Lebesgue measure on the circle. So more technically, one can state that whenever one takes a continuous function on the circle and one integrates on the left-hand side the empirical distribution, which is random against f, this gives a certain random variable which converges almost surely as n tends to infinity to the right-hand side, which is just a simple integral of the function around the circle. So the right-hand side is non-random, whereas the left-hand side is. Now, it's not really very important how one fits together the different probability distributions for the different n's. It doesn't really matter how this is done. That's not the issue. What's important here is that one gets almost sure convergence as n goes to infinity. The right-hand side of this is hardly a surprise, given the fact that the problem is rotationally invariant. I just want to introduce a little bit of notation. The trace ideals are CPN are the usual von Neumann-Schatten ideals, and they're going to be normalized so that when I take a typical n by n matrix, I'm going to take 1 over n times a trace x adjoint x to the power p over 2 the whole lot to the power 1 over p. So this is going to be an increasing expression as p increases. And this is going to be used especially for the case of p equals 2 in the first instance. And we're going to introduce a corresponding family of norms on t to the n. We're going to take the norm, well, say the distance between sequences of angles. To be normalized like that. Okay. So, the first theorem is going to be proved using some concentration of measure results. Okay. We start by taking the Haar probability measure on the group of unitaries. Throughout the section, I'm just going to be focusing on the beta equals 2 case, and we're only going to be talking about unitary matrices, so some of this will extend. Now, we're going to take the normalized Hilbert-Schmidt metric on the group of unitaries and consider a function which is one Lipschitz from that space into the real numbers, and we're going to suppose that its average with respect to the Haar measure is 0. Then for such a function, one gets a concentration inequality which asserts that when I take the multiple by t of that and integrate with respect to the measure, I get less than or equal to exponential of c t squared by n. Now, it's important that this inequality improves as n increases. In other words, things get better as the size of the matrices increase. This is crucial in what follows. So it's t squared by n, and c can be taken as some absolute constant. Now, the proof of this result is essentially contained in work of Gromov and Milman, and it really depends on the fact that the Ricci curvature of u of n is at least as big as a constant multiple of n. And from that, one can use the theorems of Gromov and Milman to establish such a concentration inequality. Right. Now, this was not the measure in which we wanted to actually prove the result. So what we have to do is to move from this measure into the measure which describes the statistical mechanics. And the corollary asserts that one can do this. That is to say, one can get a similar result. If we take a function which is Lipschitz, this time going from the phase space of angles with this normalized L2 metric, and if one assumes that it's got average value 0 with respect to the ensemble, then it satisfies a similar inequality with the same sort of constant. That is to say, the constant on the right-hand side is improving in n. It's of the style c times t squared by n. Now, it's really this corollary which is used to establish the almost sure convergence. Okay.
So, I think you say again, how far does it pass from the R measure to the
No. Corollary obtained with the following lemma. Right. Now, there's a bit of a story behind this. The obvious thing that's going on here is one is taking a matrix and one's diagonalizing it. That's why these things are the eigenvalues. And there is a map which associates to the unitary its eigenvalues, and one can take these to be ordered in that sense by putting them around the circle in that particular order. So this gives a map lambda, which goes from the unitaries down to the maximal torus, that is to say the diagonal unitary operators. Now, one can deduce from results of Lipsky that this map is Lipschitz with a certain constant k that does not depend on n. This is a fairly straightforward functional calculus argument. And what one does, essentially, is to take the circle and to introduce a certain smooth partition of unitary on the circle by taking bump functions of this kind, and one can just sort of chop up the spectrum and then recombine the different parts of the circle and put them back together again. It's a fairly standard functional calculus argument, but I'd like to point out that one does need to be fairly careful about how one normalizes the Schatten norms to do this operation. It's not purely a statement which can be made in general about eigenvalues. One has to normalize this carefully so that the operator norm, which one uses for the functional calculus, does actually control the size of the Schatten norms. But The main ingredient in this result is a theorem of Lipsky, which is contained in all the standard books on trace ideals. Now, with this, one can check quite easily that the measure up here is taken down to the measure sigma, down one level below. That's to say that lambda induces the measure sigma from the Haar measure. Right? And then one can observe the fact that this diagram at the top is going to commute. If one has a Lipschitz function going from the circle to the reals, one can pull it back to a function which goes from U of n to R, and everything in the diagram is going to be Lipschitz. So this means that one can deduce the previous result by means of the lemma and get the corollary, possibly with a worse constant, but one which is still improving with n. Right. Okay. I'm now just going to show how one can deduce almost sure weak convergence from the concentration inequalities. What we're going to do is observe that the function f, little f, in the theorem was an arbitrary continuous function, but one can approximate such functions by Lipschitz functions. So we're going to consider a function f going from the circles to the reals. Take this to be L Lipschitz, and the trick basically is to introduce a function capital theta . Now the clearest way to think of this is just by working out the function little f at each of the angles like that, and these are random points, so this is in a sense a random variable on the left hand side. But one can also think of this as being the integral of the function f of e to the I theta against the empirical measure, like that. Now, this expression is also Lipschitz. That's very easy to check. Going from the torus with a special normalized metric into the reals. And we'll just observe that the mean value be taken to be a number mn. And it's not difficult to show that mn is actually going to be converging to the integral of f with respect to the normalized Lebesgue measure. This is easy to see from rotation invariance. Now, by the corollary, now, when I subtract off this extra average, the mn's, and integrate with respect to the angle, I get less than the exponential ct squared. I've got L squared, because it's an L Lipschitz function. K is this extra constant which appeared from the lemma, but things are still improving as n increases. And mm-hmm.
completely lost touch. Are we still talking about Johansson's theorem? Or?
Okay, so we're going through a proof of Johansson's theorem.
Yes.
Okay, good. And that's the program for the lecture. Okay, good.
Yes. Now, just using Chebyshev's inequality, the probability with respect to sigma that this Fn is minus Mn is bigger than epsilon is going to be bounded by the following exponential expression. Like that. And one can optimize this. And consider the other case in which this can be taken to be negative, get a similar result. And one can show the probability that the modulus of Fn minus Mn being bigger than epsilon is going to be bounded by constant times e to the minus n epsilon squared, divided by, which I believe is 4, k squared l squared. So we get that from the concentration inequality. Now, again, this estimate improves with n. Right. Now, the point is about this expression is that as n increases, the right-hand side goes to infinity at an exponential rate, so I can sum this expression over n. And get a finite answer. Okay. Now, most proofs of almost sure convergence seem to reduce to something like the Borel-Cantelli lemma, and this is how we make the finish. Now, observe, it doesn't really make much difference how I attempt to link the probabilities over different n. I'm just summing them here. We're only concerned with distribution of one at a time. It's not really a question about joint distributions in this type of problem. So by the first of the Borel-Cantelli lemmas, the probability that the size of Fn minus Mn being bigger than epsilon for infinitely many n is just zero. This can be taken for any positive epsilon, and we deduce that the random variable Fn minus Mn is tending to zero almost surely as n tends to infinity. Okay, so from this one can see that given the concentration inequalities and given good behavior of the constants, one can go through this fairly simple and standard argument to deduce almost sure convergence. So the key aspect of the proof is getting some inequality of this form, and then we can just go through the rest regardless of the shape of the ensemble. Right? So, I'm now going to describe other cases in which one can do the same.
So, presumably, this proof you just gave is a new proof, right?
Yes.
And the point, your point is that this proof is so flexible that you can use it in lots of places.
Right. The setup is the following. We take M to be a space of matrices, and we're going to take H to be a Lie group acting on it. I'll just take this to be compact. I need the Haar measure, usually. Compact Lie group. The action of the Lie group on the space of matrices can be essentially an affine transformation. That means it can be something like conjugation, or it can be an action by translation, and so on. We'll consider both cases in what follows. These are what are technically known as affine transformations. Now, one can then form the quotient space M over H, and this is what's usually called in the theory the phase space. Right. So the phase space is going to be the part of the model which contains the interesting measure, whereas one needs to introduce, apparently, an extra measure nu on the space M in order to get the interesting measure sigma. And the idea is that we'll be able to induce the interesting measure sigma on the phase space from some probability measure on M, which we have to be careful about choosing. Right? So that is the setup. Now, as a starter, I can describe in these terms the example which we've just gone through. We take the unitary matrices, and we, for our space of matrices M, we also take this to be the compact Lie group, and we take the action of the space of matrices on themselves to be the standard conjugation operation. Now, this is not a surprise. What one learns in elementary linear algebra, that one can diagonalize a matrix using unitary transformations. This is all that is going on here. Now, the diagonal matrices can also be thought of as being the maximal torus. Okay? And if one starts off with the Haar measure on U of N, one assuredly does not end up with the Haar measure on the maximal torus. One ends up with this unitary ensemble, which has been denoted by sigma 2. Okay? And the invariance properties which give these ensembles their name, stated at the end, essentially the ensemble is going to be the unique measure which has the invariance property, and in this case it's going to be unique up to invariance by unitary conjugation. Okay, so this is an example which we've just described. So, we can now do two at once. Maybe we can focus on the one in green first. This is a so-called orthogonal circular ensemble. Orthogonal refers to the group O of N here. This is going to act on the larger group U of N, not by conjugation, but by left translation in this case. So what we do is we take a unitary matrix and multiply on the left by an orthogonal matrix. This is the space of cosets, which one forms here for the quotient space. Now, it is a little bit confusing, but the normal description of the phase space in this example is not as a space of cosets, but as being the space of symmetric U of N matrices. And one gets between these two by a multiplication operation. It's a little bit confusing, but one can just check from the literature that these two descriptions are indeed the same and that the measures match up. And then one gets this measure sigma n1 here, and the invariance actually refers to this alternative description of the phase space, namely that it's an action of O of n on the symmetric U of n matrices. That's what's going on here. And one can just check this in a relatively straightforward way. Moving up to the space U2 of N, one soon encounters the fact that mathematicians have got very strong opinions for or against quaternions. So there are numerous descriptions of this sympleptic ensemble, depending on whether the author does or does not want to introduce various dual operations on the quaternions. But if one decides on a quaternion-free approach, one can introduce these spinners as a compact Lie group and operate with this by the action of left multiplication on U of 2n. then the quotient space can be described either as a coset or, with another multiplication operation, one can convert this into the self-dual U2 of n matrices with the Haar measure. The self-dual U2 of n matrices, and the ensemble is a unique measure on this space, which is invariant under the action associated with that one. And one gets this measure by taking down the measure from the Haar group on U2n. Right. These are very classical facts about Lie groups. They're almost implicit in Dyson's paper. Right. One begins to see why this exponent 4 appears when one does consider quaternions. It makes some point aspects of this more evident. Now, if one just tracks through the proof of theorem 1, we'll see that in these two cases, the theorem goes through with essentially the same proofs, and there's not very much variation needed. Okay. Now, recently, there's been a considerable amount of work done on other classical Lie groups from this point of view. Now, we can at least describe this in terms of the formalism which I've just introduced. If one takes any compact semi-simple Lie group, there is a natural action of the group on itself by conjugation, and one learns in the elementary theory of Lie groups that elements are conjugate to points in the maximal torus. So under this action, the quotient space is the maximal torus. In the literature, the phase space, which is equivalent to the maximal torus, often describes a space of periods. And if one starts off with the Haar measure on the group, the associated measure on the maximal torus was described by Vail. He introduced a certain denominator, which I've written here as delta of x, which is obtained by taking these differences, which are vaguely reminiscent of what we had before. One takes a product over the space of all the positive roots, and this is then multiplied by its conjugate here, and then one divides through by the order of the Vail group. And that is the number of inner automorphisms of the maximal torus that are given by inner automorphisms of the whole group. So that's what the normalizing constant here is. And now we come to the question which Keith asked. Lemma 4 was the result which associated Lipschitz functions on the group with Lipschitz functions on the quotient space. Now, one is dealing with smooth manifolds here. Everything is differentiable. But there's a problem. The results, to me, do not seem to give, in many cases, effective estimates on the constants. By which I mean, one knows that these constants, k, are going to be finite, but one doesn't seem to know what they are. Now, part of the problem seems to me to come from the following fact. A semi-simple Lie group can be described in terms of its Killing form, and the condition is that the Killing form be non-degenerate. This is not a condition which actually contains an explicit constant. So although one can associate Lipschitz functions on the two spaces, I don't claim any results with effective bounds on the constants. And this means that one cannot go through the rest of the procedure of letting n go to infinity and going through whole families of Lie groups. So one can at least set up the problem in this sense, but unless one has further information about the particular examples, it's difficult to bring this through to a successful conclusion.
So when you say effective, you mean that you simply have no bounds, don't think bounds good enough, check would be good enough to follow through, you mean no bounds at all? Because it's just the facts are.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know of anything I can write down. But in particular cases, I'm sure that if people did enough work, they could come up with something. But I'm not even claiming that they're going to improve with n. That's anything that improves with n is good enough. But I don't have such an estimate. Right, so that's the generalities. So now I want to go back to the Genwise orthogonal ensemble and show how this can be described in the same sort of formalism. And basically this is where the story began, because this is the case which I calculated first before doing the other ones. Orthogonal refers to the action, and the action takes place on the space of real symmetric matrices. Now, this was a model which was introduced in about 1995 by Pasteur and co-workers to describe various models in physics. Now, the large space of matrices is the space of real symmetric n by n matrices. We want to get estimates and to take n out to infinity. Now, the phase space is basically the space of ordered eigenvalues, which turns out to be essentially the space of diagonal matrices. There is no reason to suppose these are positive or small. They can extend over the whole of the line. I'll say a little bit more about once I sketch that. Now, there are various measures which one can put on the space of real symmetric matrices. It's perhaps useful to point out that one can put Lebesgue measure in each of the matrix entries, and that, of course, will give one a nice measure which is invariant under addition, translation, but it won't be a probability measure, obviously. To make it a probability, one has to have some sort of cutoff, and that is introduced by means of a potential, which is going to be a function which goes from the real symmetric matrices and which we're going to assume is convex in a very strict sense. Now, from this, one can go through a calculation which is reminiscent of the proof of the vowel denominator formula. One ends up with a product of the differences of the eigenvalues. In the case of orthogonal ensembles, the power is still 1. If you want to talk about unitary ensembles, you can get squares, or in symplectic ensembles, you can get fourth powers. So this is basically what one had before. The extra feature is we've now got a potential to add. And the theorem is that the ensembles which we've introduced satisfy quadratic transportation inequality, they satisfy Gaussian-type isoperimetric inequalities, and they also satisfy concentration inequalities for Lipschitz functions with the norms which I introduced earlier. What's important is that the constants actually improve as n goes to infinity. Now, I've somewhat anticipated this and made things easy for myself by putting an n squared in there. So I'm making the measure kill off very fast. So I'm making things easy for myself. And if I put an n squared in there, it does actually help the constants a great deal at this stage in the construction. But it is reasonable to have an n squared in there for reasons which I'll indicate in a moment. Now, under these conditions, there is convergence of the empirical distributions almost surely, and they converge almost surely to some non-random probability distribution as n goes to infinity. Okay. There isn't a very simple method for determining what rho is, but it can be determined using the theory of integral equations in certain cases, depending upon V. Okay. Now, perhaps I'd better elaborate a little bit on what the explicit statement of this result is. Okay. And just state what is meant by uniform convexity. Uniformity in this context refers to the dimension. The constants which I write down here must be independent of the choice of n. Now, the P refers to the fact that one is considering the Schatten norms, CPn, and it's a pth power here. This notion is only sensible for values of P at least as big as 2. Now, the left-hand side is the expression which one normally considers in terms of convexity. If you want something convex, you want this to be positive. What we're stating explicitly is how positive we want this to be. We want this to be a bigger expression than the norm, right? And there is an extra constant introduced here for technical reasons, which will become clear in a moment. But it's enough to think of this inequality actually in the case of s equals t equals a half. That condition implies what has been written down here, so long as v is continuous, as it is in all cases. Right.
Is that c times s plus k over s? I'm thinking it will be no s. In front of the x minus y for v.
S plus k subscript s.
Right, okay.
And k subscript s divided by s goes to zero. Right. So that's what's meant by something uniformly p-convex. Remind you, we've seen it before, relative entropy is defined by means of taking a density against a logarithmic density. And we're going to be taking these with respect to the ensemble, which is specified in terms of dx, the big measure on the matrix entries, and then minus n squared v of x. And what we're asserting is that the transportation inequality holds for the cost function, which is given by the norms on the Schatten ideals. And that is to say, the Wasserstein distance with this cost function is bounded by the relative entropy, and the constants here are a constant depending on p divided by n squared. So this is a term which is improving as n squared increases. Right.
So can we understand this as a consequence of some kind of p displacement convexity of the entropy?
See the forthcoming proof. Yes. Yes. Okay, is there anything further on this before we depart from it? Okay. Right. Okay, now the model to think of in this case is to take the eigenvalues as being along the line, the eigenvalue real symmetric matrix. At each eigenvalue, I place a unit positive charge, right? Charges will tend to repel one another, so one would not get convergence. However, to balance things up, I wish to make these particles attract towards zero. To do this, I introduce a convex function v, such as x squared or x to the power p, where p is bigger than 2. Right. So these particles are attracted towards zero, which would tend to make them all forced to one point. They repel under electrostatic repulsion. The combination of these two factors gives a total potential. As n goes to infinity, if the constants are selected correctly, the two effects will balance. Right. Now, there are, roughly speaking, n squared pairs of particles. Right. That is why I need to put an n squared multiplying the potential to get some hope of things balancing up as n goes to infinity. If I choose another factor, things will not have any chance of converging. Oh, yeah. Well, that wouldn't make any difference. Okay. So this is the model. I think the transportation is done at dimension n, actually. Okay. going to introduce, following Morey, a certain expression. Like that. And we're going to take S and T to add up together to give 1. And the point is that by uniform convexity, the CP norm difference between the matrices can be bounded above by LS together with some constants. And K of S is going to go to 0 as S goes to 0. And now we're going to take F and G to be continuous. Bounded, and we're going to suppose that their difference is smaller than what's going to be the transportation cost. Okay? So this is going to be the basis for a certain duality argument. But the main inequality is actually Prokopa-Langler. So I've normalized things to be a probability. That's the new n. Now, this quantity turns out to be at least as great as the exponential integral. And involving G and the corresponding one involving the function f, but with a different choice of sign second time round. And the powers are 1 over S, 1 over T. We now let S go to 0. I'm going to restore the fact that it's a measure nu n under consideration. This is to be bounded by the exponential integral n squared g d nu n, like that. So we can just make the finish. The relative entropy is going to be the supremum of H against the measure dW, and the constraint which I impose is the exponential integral of the same function H against nu n be less than or equal to 1. Right. One can check using various elementary inequalities that this is a valid formula for entropy. So we can choose h of x to be n squared f of x minus that. That is the purpose of this inequality here. I can take the stuff on the right across the left and get something smaller than 1. The integrals are against nu n. Right. So then, we can then just use another duality argument. Kantorovich-Rubinstein theorem says that the Wasserstein distance, the pth power, for this particular cost function is going to be given by a certain constant times a supremum. Now, the expression one recognizes is f of x against w minus the integral of g of y against d nu, and the constraint imposed is that the functions be less than c upon p times this cost function like that. Okay. So once one multiplies this through by n squared and uses that, we get that the entropy of W with respect to nu n is bounded by some constant that when we round. Once one has got that, there's a well-established theory which begins with Martin and proceeds through results of Bobkov and Goetze, which allow one to obtain all the other inequalities from that. And that part of the argument was discussed in the lecture which was given earlier this week by Ledoux. Okay, so I've given you the essential ingredients for what's needed to finish the proof. Okay. So.